I got fired. I'm glad I did, because I would have stayed. Because it was my first job out of school, and I was like, I need some experience from somewhere. I would have stayed probably at least 6 months or a year, just like tough it out. I've never failed at anything. I was let go. It was a bad day, and I was just like, oh my gosh, what do I do? What do I do now? It was hard enough to find this one job, and now I have to try and find another one.
This is the Pivotal Moments podcast. I'm your host, John Lamb, and each week I interview a new guest to learn lessons from the pivotal moments in their lives. My guest this week is Jill Jacobson, a senior UX designer on my team. I still remember the day when I met Jill in the DevDiv design team's team room in Building 17 during the middle of a Seattle winter. We were transitioning the design work for Azure Notebooks from another UX designer who was moving on to work on other things in the division. She was only part-time on Azure Notebooks, but Jill was going to be full-time. Since then, Jill has gone on to become an invaluable member of our team. I know the phrase out-of-the-box thinking is an overused phrase these days, but Jill really did come with a completely different perspective. She had never done UX interaction design before, but I didn't know that until today. Jill has a really interesting and unique story to tell. She's an incredibly creative person whose talents extend well beyond designing user interfaces, as you'll hear about later. From that base of creativity, she has gone on to have a strong career at Microsoft, but there were definitely some twists and turns along the way. Let's start by looking at some of the things that Jill does in her job as a UX designer at Microsoft. In this first story, we look back on a specific design problem that we had. Why were users churning out of our Jupyter Notebook support in VS Code? Let's begin by learning a little bit more about what a UX designer does at Microsoft.
Depends who you ask. It's one of those things that means something different everywhere you go. It's like the same as PM. Every company kind of defines it a little bit different. We've got people with different skill sets who do different things. And it also depends where you work as far as your scope of work. There's a couple sub roles within design. We've got traditional graphic design, which usually in more UX applications is called visual designs. Examples include typography, color, imagery, style, and layout, brand design. Then we've got on designers and illustration who fit into that as well. So when you think about design, that's traditional visual aspects of design. We also have interaction design, which is how does input manifest visually, or how does a certain type of input create a different result?
One of the things that I learned about while working with Jill was a set of control libraries that we have that are standardized and shared across products. This ensures that we have a familiar experience across all our products, and it also lets designers, PMs, and engineers delegate a lot of the details around accessibility and localization to a centralized team of experts. This frees Jill up to focus more on understanding the customer needs and creating an interaction model that best meets their needs.
We here at Microsoft have a lot of shared design libraries and frameworks that we leverage. So my role relies less on the visual design and interaction design pieces because we typically have prior art to pull from for that. So my role really is more about, what does our customer need? What do they expect? And how do we make sure that what we're providing them is meeting their needs and expectations? The types of information that you're trying to provide typically have a format or a shape that makes the most sense for what they are. So whether something is a binary choice or a choice from a list of things or composable elements. And because we have so many pre-existing products, not only do we have the small, most granular components of an individual button or an individual checkbox, we also have what we call interaction patterns or composite widgets, which is like, here's a whole panel with 15 different fields, and here's how you can relate a bunch of stuff together in a wizard and stuff like that. So it saves us a lot of effort designing stuff from scratch, The teams that build those libraries also look out for things like accessibility and color contrast and theming and making sure that the components are built with all of the appropriate labels to be read by a screen reader and stuff like that. Because those things are really important to how we build our products, it's nice to not have to think about that granular of a level every single time we want to add like one button to the UI. So being able to leverage the libraries and components is really important.
Jill is the master of a design tool called Figma. It lets her quickly pull together interactive prototypes that we can test with customers, often in interactive sessions using a process that we call Quick Pulses in DevDiv. While we often learn valuable things in these sessions, it can also be very painful for the PMs and designers as they watch users struggle with things that seem so simple and obvious to them.
I think one of the things that you learn very quickly, especially in any field where you have to communicate things to other people, people don't read. Like, ever. So any dialogue box, status message, blah, 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 they just don't read. So that has been something that I've always tried to take to heart. Let's be careful about how we use words. Try not to rely on people reading things and give them the most important information where it's relevant. I think in complex tools like we build, there's a lot of things going on in a lot of places. So maintaining context on messaging is really important.
One of the controversial things that we had was, where should the kernel picker be for the Jupyter extension? And where would it be in such a way that the user would actually be able to find it and use it? And that was this multi-month long adventure that we all went on.
Yes, that was a good time. It comes back to the purpose of UX design, which is, what does your customer need and what do they expect? And I think one of the biggest challenges we got for Jupyter inside of VS Code was, we have two potential different customers. So someone who is really comfortable with VS Code expects one experience. Someone who's completely used to Jupyter and is now using it inside of a new tool, completely different expectations. So
the reason why we had this challenge was that there were two customer types that we were trying to reach with the tool. The first customer was already a VS Code user and wanted to use the notebook experience that we created, as they were familiar with the VS Code user interface idioms. The other was a Jupyter user who wanted to use the features of VS Code and were willing to switch to gain benefits of using a single tool rather than two tools. This user wasn't familiar with VS Code user interface idioms, and to them, we had moved a lot of the UX that they were familiar with to different places because that was where a VS Code user expected those things to be. So we had a mystery, and we set out to try and solve it. We had complaints about not being able to switch kernels, so we tried to create different experiences for picking kernels that were consistent with VS Code design idioms, but it wasn't as easy as it looked.
I think one of the biggest red flags for me was, we would do customer studies and all of our results were inconclusive. We would recruit people for these studies based on particular criteria, and they met the criteria, we'd make sure of that. In a simple example, we did an A-B test. Where do they look for XYZ thing? When you get a 50-50 split, you can't make any conclusive decisions. We're not able to get good answers because we're not granular enough on defining the customer and their expectations. Okay, people who use notebooks, they have a variety of backgrounds. How familiar are they with software development? Or do they come from more of the data business insight side of the discipline? And what are they familiar with? It becomes pretty clear when you start to ask those questions that different people care about different things. We've discovered that people who are labeled data scientist are as diverse as people labeled UX designer. There's so many different levels of expertise and experience. So it's honestly something we're still trying to figure out. I don't know if we've really gotten there yet, but I'm really proud of the effort that this team has been putting into trying to understand our customers more.
The entire team needed to understand the differences between data scientists who use Jupyter primarily and developers. Even though both write code to do their work, they do so in fundamentally different ways. A Jupyter user is very different from a VS Code user, is very different from a VS Code engineer.
I think there's a degree to which we need to recognize that we are not the customer and continue to have curiosity around that. And I think testing your own product is a big part of that too, is just, okay, we did this feature because everyone really wanted it, but I don't understand how, it's not useful to me necessarily, but some people seem to really want it. So like, what is it about their workflow that's different than my workflow that makes them?
So it seems like there's this curiosity element that really needs to always be present. And if you lose that, or worse, you start believing your own bullshit, then that becomes really bad, right? That turns into an echo chamber. And once upon a time, the entire PM discipline was invented at Microsoft to circumvent that problem. The original PMs were the people that were trying to bring some customer empathy for the users of Office products into the engineering team. They're writing code. What did they know about the needs of someone coding up an Excel spreadsheet, or what did they know about the needs of someone using Word?
There were also different channels for feedback. VS Code users used the VS Code GitHub issues to submit feedback to the engineering team. Jupyter users used different places to submit feedback. Sometimes it was GitHub issues on the Jupyter projects. Other times it was on forums or mailing lists. One thing was sure, though, none of them were using the VS Code GitHub issues to submit feedback for Jupyter.
But one of the struggles that we had was VS Code is very much a GitHub-centric ecosystem community environment. That's where their customers live. That's where people share stuff and discuss things and comment on things. And the Jupyter customers don't really have a presence there. So when we started to put things out through the VS Code channels, say, hey, give us feedback on these experiences and things that we're thinking about, it was a lot of crickets because we didn't get the same volume of community engagement through those particular channels on some of the more data science stuff versus the VS Code stuff. And I think that's a challenge whenever you're adding new customers to an existing product. It's not a place that they live yet. You're trying to get them to move there, but they don't live in the neighborhood, so they're not going to see the posters that you put up on the fence, right?
Right.
So that, I think, was part of the challenge, is how do we find our customers in order to talk to them?
This challenge of getting user feedback continues to be a challenge to this day. The hard work of the team has continued to grow usage and satisfaction over time, but we don't really think of the product as being anywhere close to being done. So you can see that the work that Jill does as a UX designer overlaps with the work that a PM does. In fact, I like to think of her as half a PM, straddling the line between interaction design and customer understanding. Some of the best people that I've worked with at the company are like that as well. They understand deeply the other disciplines that they need to work with. At one point, I used to work with a distinguished engineer who was called by his boss half a PM. But Jill wasn't born a UX designer. In fact, Jill didn't even go to school to learn how to be a UX designer. In this next story, we learn about how she went to school to study industrial design.
Well, I didn't start here, and I certainly didn't think I would end up here. I started in industrial design, which is the design of physical products. That's what I went to school for. That's what brought me out to Washington. And so I graduated in industrial design, wanted to stay in the Pacific Northwest, and job opportunities were not awesome at that point in time. I did a couple of internships. I had a job briefly. It was not a good fit.
Before we get to talking about why it wasn't a good fit, we first need to learn how Jill picked industrial design in the first place.
I took an aptitude test when I was in high school through an organization based out of Texas called Ames. They essentially measure unlearned abilities. So it's not a knowledge test, it's not an IQ test, it's sort of the natural abilities that your brain has to create new ideas, spatial thinking, dexterity. They have one called ideaphoria. There's analytical elements. There's memory elements. I'd always been creative. I'd always been into art, but I wasn't had any awareness of what sort of creative careers beyond being like an art teacher or trying to make it as a professional artist, like what else is there? So that is what took me to industrial design. They looked at my skill set, which is a lot of analytical thinking, systems thinking, spatial reasoning. And they were like, you would be great at this. And I was like, what is industrial design? I've never heard of that. So that's what kind of set me on the path of looking at industrial design. Turns out it's a pretty small world as far as professions go. There's only a dozen options for schools, and I didn't want to go to like specifically an art college. I wanted to have other opportunities. So that's how I ended up at Western Washington University, which has a bachelor's of science in industrial design. So it's got some of the physics and math and material science and manufacturing stuff kind of built into it, which is very valuable when you actually get into the industry of learning how to make things that can be real.
So industrial design seemed to be a great fit for her artistic background, her desire to create things, and her analytical systems thinking mind.
It was like, oh, I get to make stuff. That was like the main appeal. Like, I'd always been the kid who was like, I'm going to make a backpack out of duct tape and figure out how to make my own like adjustable strap hardware and that kind of thing. Like, that was me. And I was always just like building stuff. My dad's an engineer too, so there was a lot of building of things and problem solving happening. So the fact that I could do that as a real job was very appealing to me.
Industrial design is at its core multidisciplinary, and Jill picked up a lot of esoteric knowledge during her education.
Clay, foam, wood, sheet metal. We had a lot of really fun shop classes in school where we got to build prototypes of different stuff. That just appealed to me. It's a way to make things and solve problems in a professional capacity. And I was like, that sounds perfect. So I have all kinds of weird knowledge, albeit preliminary knowledge, you know, just enough to be dangerous in how metal extrusions work and how to do a snap fit on injection molded plastic and how to design things for 3D printing, what kind of manufacturing processes you can do. So in the basement of our design building, we had our design model shop upstairs, and in the basement they had spots where you could do carbon fiber layups, vacuum molded plastic, true material science manufacturing labs happening in the basement.
But it's not just about being able to build cool things using your hands or machines. Jill learned the business side of industrial design as well.
And then a big part of the industrial design industry is it's a lot of consulting. So you learn about storytelling, how to put together good presentations and pitches and talk about your ideas, and then also how to do customer research and solve customer problems. So inventing and entrepreneurship and experience design, manufacturing design, all rolled into one. It's like, it's a little bit of everything.
So when she was done at school, we can return to the story about how her first job wasn't a good fit. There's a bit of youthful idealism mixed in with mismatched expectations, resulting in an important lesson to be learned.
I was just applying to any industrial design role that I could. This was a small consulting firm. Part of the reason they hired me was because I did have the experience in and some knowledge of manufacturing. I had a bit of background in that, so that definitely appealed. I didn't have the experience in the part of the process that they really excel in as a firm. Which is really more about bringing people's ideas to life with engineering and manufacturing. Mm-hmm. I know some stuff about that, but that was never really where my passion was in design. I kind of got myself into trouble. I was hired in to replace someone who had about 10 years of experience. So there was a mismatch of expectations. I think when I was like, hey, so they have this idea, but I have like potentially 3 or 4 better ideas of how to do this thing. Can we explore some alternatives so that we can actually make this the best thing instead of just like making the thing that they wanted? That was not how that business was meant to be run, but me being a naive, never having worked in consultancy person, that didn't connect for me. Mm-hmm. I was, I think, still in that, you know, fresh, young, idealistic phase where you're like, we have the opportunity to make the best thing that we can. And we love that energy from our interns. But there's a level of realism that I just didn't have yet, which made that role really a challenge. So I was second guessing stuff and ended up missing some deadlines or going over hours, because again, you're consulting, so it's hourly. Billing. So I ended up going over on some of the things that shouldn't have been, which was difficult for the business. So like from their point of view, I also understand how that was not a good fit. I got fired. I'm glad I did, because I would have stayed. Because it was my first job out of school, and I was like, I need some experience from somewhere. I would have stayed probably at least 6 months or a year, just like tough it out. I've never failed at anything. I was let go. It was a bad day, and I was just like, oh my gosh, what do I do? What do I do now? It was hard enough to find this one job, and now I have to try and find another one.
Getting fired, as difficult as it may seem at the time, can sometimes be the best thing to happen to us. But Jill didn't rebound straight into Microsoft. Jill would return to her roots as an artist while figuring out what the next step would be in her career.
So I was dating my husband at the time. His family lives in Seattle. I was renting a room in someone's house close to where that job was. It didn't make sense to be there anymore. We had a couple family friends in the area who actually just kind of like took me in. And I was like, hey, can I come live with you for a bit until I find my next thing? And they were wonderful. I got a job working as a painting instructor at Paint and Sip. So going back to my art experience background, I started working nights and weekends and corporate events, doing like Bob Ross style painting, which was really fun. Didn't pay all that well, but it was something to kind of get me by for a while.
While Art was paying the bills and giving her time and space to regroup, Jill wanted to give industrial design another shot.
I continued to look for jobs during that time, tried to like work on some different software skills and design skills that I was interested in, and just kind of tried to keep going. Then I found an internship doing industrial design again. I'm not above going back and being an intern again. Internships can turn into jobs. I just need to take whatever opportunity is there. So it was a little bit of a pride check, which I think I needed.
Internships are really good in that they're like a 12-week job interview. It goes both ways. Can you do the job from the employer's perspective? And is this where I want to work from your perspective?
Yeah. So I started an internship. It was originally 3 months, then it extended to 6 months. It became clear toward the end that I wasn't going to get a job offer. They just had other roles that they needed to fill in the company. Not that they didn't want me to stay, but they were like, we can't make you a full-time employee with salary and all that.
Getting a second shot was also an opportunity to take a hard look at whether industrial design was a good long-term fit for Jill's interests and talents. It was becoming increasingly obvious to her that maybe it wasn't.
But it also highlighted for me a values mismatch between me and industrial design as a discipline. There's a lot of disposability, like making, to use someone else's phrase, cheap plastic crap. I don't really want to be in a place where I'm working on stuff that I don't believe in, which I know is a very millennial thing to say. But I was like, I think I can do better as far as like being in a place where I get to do the type of work that I enjoy and feel satisfied with what I'm producing in the end, rather than always trying to cut corners for cost or simplify things or going with a less good solution because it is 5 parts instead of 15 parts. So the manufacturing cost is a lot lower. And it was just a lot of those types of trade-offs. I don't love having to do this. And so that to me was one of the biggest mismatches. And then my interest has always been, and I referenced this when I had that first job, was I liked the problem-solving piece. I was never really as interested in the form giving, the visual design of physical products is form giving, making it match the brand language and how you're applying colors and finishes and stuff like that. There are some people who are amazing at that, and it just wasn't me. That was just never my thing. I wanted to be on the who is the customer? What is the problem? How can we solve it? Can we solve more than one thing at once? Does it make sense?
That's the optimization you're interested in, is the
functionality
and not the form.
I think at my core, I am an optimizer. Mm-hmm. And you've maybe noticed that in the work that we've done together. But it's just like, how do we do it the best way?
Right.
And do things that really make sense on every single level and follow principles and are really well-grounded. I was looking for an opportunity to do more of that mm-hmm. in whatever role or career I was in.
Yeah.
So ironically, at one point, one of my past mentors was a lead UX director. Are you sure you don't want to do UX? I'm like, no. I want to stay in product. Mm. And then ironically, here I am. So he knew better than I knew at that point. But that's the journey, right?
So now Jill had to figure out what to do next. If it wasn't going to be industrial design, working with atoms, perhaps it could be something in tech, working with electrons.
I wanted to stay for my husband and his family. It was like not the right time in my personal life to try and move somewhere else. So I was like, okay, Seattle. If we're going to stay here, what are good industries to be in Seattle? I wonder what that could be.
If I'm not designing planes for Boeing.
Yeah. How do I take the skills that I have and try and get into the tech piece? One of the skill sets that I had been building up was illustration. Vector illustration and stuff like that, just because it's fun and I enjoyed doing it. So I got in touch with a couple of recruiting agencies and I was like, hey, I'm interested in doing UX design. I understand I don't have the portfolio from it, but I do have illustration skills. Maybe I can get my foot in the door somewhere doing visual design, illustration, brand design, because I'd done some of that stuff. So I went the agency route. The agencies in Seattle have a lot of connections to tech, so they would send me jobs for Xbox and Facebook and Microsoft and blah, blah, blah. So that's how I ended up here. They sent me one for a UX product designer on notebooks in developer division, and I was like, I don't know what any of these things are, but I'll like at least do the informational interview to hear about what that job might be like.
Right.
So this takes us back to the beginning of the show where I first met Jill. I thought I was getting a full-time UX designer for notebooks, but I was really getting a raw, talented, but completely inexperienced designer. Let's pick up the story again, this time from Jill's point of view.
So nobody here really knew about my background, except for obviously the people who hired me, and I did my portfolio review and I was like, I haven't really done UX design. I did a couple projects in college, whatever, that had UX elements to them. But I was fortunate to have a manager who recognized that the skills that I had would be very transferable. She was like, you'll be fine. There's some stuff that you need to learn, like Figma, you've never touched it.
In the early days of Azure Notebooks, we had hired an external agency to do a redesign of the user interface. The previous user interface was designed by engineers, and it showed. The new interface was much, much better. But now we wanted to take the work in-house, and that was where Jill entered the picture.
My first project when I came here was to take the designs that the consultancy had done and just rebuild it in Figma. So that we would have files for it. I was trying to rebuild the stuff, but I was like, this component is not in the library or what's happening in this part of the UI. It makes no sense. So I was already starting to recognize some of the gaps as we were putting it together, but I didn't know anything about software development. I didn't know anything about programming. People were just throwing around these words like client and server and languages and Python and blah, blah, blah. I would just keep lists of things to look up and just try and wrap my brain around what was even happening.
Jill wanted to make the most of the opportunity, and she knew that she needed to ramp up in the problem domain any way that she could.
So I think for probably about 6 months, I don't know if I did a whole lot except sit in on every single meeting I could possibly get an invite to, including every engineering stand-up.
And that explains all that. Because I was always wondering, why is Jill coming to our stand-up? This is kind of boring stuff. And
I just needed to learn. Mm-hmm. And even though I was like completely lost most of the time, I slowly started to be able to, because I can think in systems, I can relate things together. So it was really just to build my mental scaffold of how do all these pieces fit together. And then sometimes I would put in a tentative comment like, well, a good experience would be to do X, Y, Z. Is there like a reason why we can't do that? I learned a lot by operating that way. I think assuming good intentions is really important, especially when you join a new team. If things aren't awesome, there's probably a reason why. People are trying to achieve a particular thing, and you need to understand what challenges they're facing and what solutions they've tried. It's the same as you would do with any customer, but you do it with your team.
After 6 months of a crash course in learning how to become a UX designer, literally on the job, a few key things started to come into focus. I find it interesting that Jill wasn't talking about the technology itself. Rather, she's talking about how much we needed to work together as a team to make a great product.
Learning to be patient. I was used to school/consulting timelines where everything turns around in a few weeks. It is not so here.
So you're saying we're slow. I see.
No, it ties into my point number two, which is nothing is ever finished. So in industrial design, you design a thing and you iterate on the thing. But as soon as you send it over to get the tooling made for like, you know, the metal plates that are going to manufacture that thing, the changes that you can make are very minor. So there's a definite done point. Learning that that does not exist in software, especially working on a tool that ships regular builds on whatever cadence, weekly, monthly, whatever. There's always time to do more or to go back or to make it better. So learning to break things down iteratively and then be able to communicate that out to the team, I think has been really crucial to what I've been able to do with the Notebooks team. As far as like advocating for, I think these things need to be in the first version because I think they're essential to how the customer will experience this feature versus I think these are nice to haves that we can look into later, and trying to help communicate, particularly to the engineers, the impact that their feature has on the customer. I think when people know what impact they're able to have and like the value of their work, I think that adds a lot to the team too.
Jill makes a great point about features that must ship now versus features that can wait. That has a lot to do with the rapid ship cycles that are commonplace in the industry today, especially for services. That wasn't always the case.
Yeah, one of the things that Microsoft didn't do once upon a time, certainly when we worked on, let's say, Windows, that was a 3-year ship cycle. You would have a train leaving the station every 3 years that would contain all of your work on it. And then if you miss that train, it's another 3 years. The worst case is the beginning of that cycle, it gets cut from the thing, ships on the next train. You could be waiting 6 years to ship your thing. And that was brutal. So that led to a lot of interesting behavior, let's call it, right? Because people tend to really optimize around trying to get their thing into that train. Whereas nowadays that we ship things almost not quite at a service level where the services can ship every day if that's what they wanted to, or multiple times a day even. So there was never that, I have to pack this release full of stuff because I'm not going to get another chance for a long, long time. The lessons that you learned, I think, are really useful for the regular shipping train thing as opposed to the once every 3 year train thing that used to exist.
Perhaps it's because it's really hard to predict how people will work out as UX designers that we have so many people transition into full-time UX roles through an agency. Jill is a great success story of how that route can be effective for listeners who might be thinking about getting a design job at Microsoft.
Whenever people reach out to me, either like through LinkedIn, school connections, whatever, and people are like, how do I get a job at Microsoft? I'm like, go through an agency, especially for design, because you at least get a foot in the door, you get some connections, you learn about it, and particularly in developer division, a lot of the stuff that we work on is so deep and complex. The onboarding time is 6 to 8 months. So chances of when a job opening comes around, are we going to hire the person who's already gone through that 6 to 8 months of onboarding, or are we going to start from scratch?
Mm-hmm.
The impact of the design team is clearly reflected across our products with happier customers and less churn. This is due in no small part to our talented and growing team of UX designers, but also to our approach to better understanding our customers.
My manager hugely advocated for hiring people, converting people. There's been a huge amount of growth on the design team inside of developer division in the last couple of years. The team has been able to prove the impact and benefit that we've been able to have in our products. Also, a huge shout out to our research team for advocating for the customer-driven and hypothesis progression framework and partnering with design. So we have the capital D design and research, really working together to do that sort of customer investigation and ideation phase. It's been a big area of investment. And so being from the design leadership standpoint, being patient in advocating and waiting for those roles and opportunities to come along, and then match the people that we do have with teams where they're able to have good impact, has been a big part.
So Jill made the transition into a full-time role. During this transition, we get an opportunity to learn even more about her creative background.
It was pretty slick for me. I mean, aside from my background check getting lost in the shuffle over Christmas vacation, it was...
Because you are Canadian, so we don't really trust you all by default, right?
Well, I have my American citizenship too, that wasn't really the issue. But yeah, I did have to do the interview process and the portfolio review, but the portfolio review really is just a fun opportunity to talk about your work with all your friends that you already work with. I brought in some of my hobby projects to show during my portfolio review because I was like, okay, well, I've been doing notebook stuff for a year, so I'll talk about that for a while. I have a teapot project that I did as my senior thesis in industrial design that my manager absolutely loved when I presented it in my vendor interviews. So I brought that back just because everyone loves to see it. And it's a good example of working through design problems and process and thinking about structure of systems. Because when you have 13 pieces that have to relate together, there's some system thinking involved there. And then I brought in some prop design stuff. I had this pirate treasure chest that I had made and some, fun, cool projects to do a show and tell.
And that's what's a bit sad nowadays, that we don't have private offices at the company. Once upon a time, I would imagine that the Jill of that era would have just brought these things and stuck them in their office. And that would just be a natural conversation piece rather than something that's locked away at home, because there's really nowhere in a team room like this to put all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, now I have my home office because I'm primarily remote, but my home office is a very Hogwarts library vibe. So I have a medieval unicorn tapestry and twinkle lights and a lion fountain and an astrolabe just chilling in the background of my team's calls. So there's a fun opportunity with hybrid to show that aspect of your personality.
Sometimes we all have a tension between the things that bring us joy and happiness and the day-to-day grind of the job that we're doing. Jill has an important lesson to teach us about the importance of taking a step back to rediscover why we do the things that bring us joy and happiness and how that can bring balance to our lives.
So you do a bunch of these other interesting things outside of work, a lot of artistic, a lot of creative things. Why do you do that?
I do it because I love it. I think I'm sad when I don't do it. I was so busy when I was in school. Highly competitive program, tons and tons of endless coursework. Just I was so busy that I kind of lost sight of a lot of the things that I like to do just because I like to do them. I think it's important to be generative. I think we're very consumptive as a culture. And for lack of a better word, it makes me kind of feel icky to just only ever consume. I have to be careful with social media because I'll watch other people painting And if I do that too much without doing any of it myself, it starts to feel negative to me. But in the right balance, watching other people do art is just sort of an inspiring reminder to myself of like, oh yeah, I love doing that too. Also, my husband and I really like to do themed parties. So we'll do very elaborate costume parties with costumes and food and music and set pieces. So we've done some Jane Austen tea parties. We've done Chronicles of Narnia party with our whole extended family. Last winter, we have a wardrobe in our living room, and so I painted a wood scene with a lamppost in it, and we put that in the wardrobe, and we made a lamppost and used it as a table centerpiece, and everyone got into costumes. So a lot of our extended family lives locally, so all the nieces and nephews like have read the books. The Beavers were there, and Mr. Tumnus. Peter made these hoof stilt shoes to wear to be Mr. Tumnus, and I was the White Witch. We love doing that stuff, so whenever we have an excuse, we'll plan an event, and then we'll make a bunch of stuff for it. Peter, my husband, his family has been doing like elaborately themed costume parties for a long time. Oh. They had already had a Downton Abbey party, Disney, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings. Hobbit parties are a favorite. So everyone dresses up like hobbits and then we just kind of like feast and play fiddle music and dance around on the deck and dig in the garden. It's amazing.
Jill rediscovered her joy of reading by, oddly enough, buying a new Kindle. Ever the optimizer, Jill teaches us how to improve our experience with two of her favorite apps, Libby and Storygraph.
I forgot that I like to read. I like rediscovered that I like to read a couple of years ago. I was like, oh, I forgot how much I love reading. Wow, this is amazing. At one point, I bought myself a Kindle. I had an old Kindle, but I realized that it was so old that it was out of technical support. It wouldn't connect to the Wi-Fi. I couldn't put anything on it. It was very old. It was from high school. I was like, okay, I'm going to get myself a new Kindle. I bet if I had it, I would use it a lot. I've used it so much.
What are your tips and tricks for the Kindle?
I just use Libby, which is the library app. Basically, every library is hooked up to this thing. And then I can use that to check out Kindle books and audiobooks. I listen to a ton of audiobooks.
And you check those from the library too?
Yep, all through the same app.
See, I'm an idiot. I just buy stuff. I'm trained to click on buy now on Amazon.
Oh, I would be broke. I tried the Audible free trial and I was like, oh yeah, audiobooks, like this will be awesome. And then I realized that it's like a credit-based system. So you're going to get one audiobook a month. And I was like, this will last me literally 3 days and then I will be toast. I use Storygraph to actually keep track of the books that I've read. I started doing it in a spreadsheet because I wanted to be able to do all the things that Storygraph can do. And then I found out about Storygraph and then I was like, oh, I don't have to manually write this all down. I like knowing the author and the title and but also the genre. It tracks things like pace, length of the book. So it gives you a lot of statistics. I particularly am interested in format, like what things do I read as like a read book on Kindle versus what do I audiobook because I consume a lot of things that way.
Do you take notes?
No, not really.
Do you highlight at all? Do something with the highlights when you're done.
Well, so it depends. So I mostly read fiction, first of all. So I don't highlight in fiction.
Sure.
I've actually started trying to read a little bit more nonfiction, but I typically do it in paper copy form because I like to be able to underline things. I've been reading a lot of books about storytelling, so most of the stuff is key notes, how to / things to think about that I will skim back through later.
Yeah, because I find that knowledge is information that went through data compression.
Okay. Yeah, I like right? that.
Like, you know, because that's what a summary really is I'm just compressing this 250-page nonfiction book into my page of notes. Things that I found that were important to me. And I find that the act of doing that is actually pretty important because it forces me to do some processing on this information, because a lot of times it just goes in one ear and out the other.
And then you retain it better.
Exactly. Right? Audiobooks are fantastic, I think, for stories, but for nonfiction, not so much, because mm-hmm. I tend to be listening to audiobooks in weird places. Like I'm driving, I'm mowing the lawn, I'm yep. something. And it just goes in one ear and out the other. A story, I think you can retain enough of the big picture of the story that you can stop and resume and stop and resume, and that's okay. But I think that for nonfiction, especially if it's dense nonfiction, that's really hard. And that's where I want to have some kind of way of doing that active recall thing where I'll finish a chapter and I'll be thinking while I'm writing the notes with the book closed, okay, what was this thing about? And forcing myself to think about the chapter. And I can't do that with audio.
There are things that enter our lives that can bring us an outsized amount of joy. Jill tells us a story about an outsized amount of joy that she got from combining her love with painting with her love of creating things.
Okay, so a couple of weeks ago, we went on a road trip down from Seattle, down the California coast to LA. So we did the Highway 1, Highway 101 thing. One of the main things we wanted to do on this trip was plein air painting. So my husband and I are both painters. He typically paints in oil. I typically paint in acrylic. And we had a plein air setup that we had used before. So essentially like
a What is a plein air?
Plein air just means like you're doing it outside from life. The people who stand in a field and paint a landscape, that's plein air painting. So you have to have equipment that you can go stand in a field and do that. We had this plein air setup. It was all right, but it didn't quite meet the needs of what we wanted to do. It was more for a small format, going to do a little watercolor kind of thing. So using our collective industrial design, because that's where we met, was in industrial design school, using our collective design and manufacturing abilities and knowledge, we designed and built a plein air setup that Peter put together for us to take on our trip. And it worked amazingly well. So being able to design something that has to please nobody but yourself is incredibly satisfying. And then not only to do that, but to have it work really, really well when you actually field test it, like better than you ever expected, it was just like hugely satisfying and delightful. It's amazing, but also dangerous, because you can look at anything and be like, oh, I can make that. Or I can make it like this, but better. And then you get down this rabbit trail of it's taken you 4 years and $1 million. Or I could have just bought the $10 thing and been okay with it. So there's a lot of talking yourself back from the cliff that needs to happen when you're able to make stuff for yourself.
Yes.
It's the risk-reward cost-benefit analysis has to happen.
Right, yeah.
And that's usually my job, because Peter is very much the idealist.
Jill's story is one of resilience, grit, and finding her way. A chance encounter with an aptitude test in high school opened her eyes to the possibilities of a career in industrial design that combined her strengths in creativity and systems thinking. While that turned out not to be the path that she would follow, it was close enough to her current path that she could reinvent herself as a UX designer in tech. That wasn't easy either, but she was fortunate enough to have found a manager who believed in her talent, and she showed her grit in quickly learning the ins and outs of complex developer tools. This brings us to the end of our time with Jill, but of course, her story doesn't end here.
I post most of my creative work on Instagram. That's my main thing right now. So it's at Jill Jack Makes, JILLJACMAKES on Instagram. I don't filter what I put on there. So it's got embroidery and painting and cake and a little bit of everything.
That's awesome. But it's who you are.
Yeah.
Right? So why filter?
Exactly.
Yeah.
A big thank you to Jill for coming on the show today. You can find her on Instagram at JillJackMakes.
Links are also available in the show notes. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, please subscribe. If you want to support the show, please tell a friend about it or leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. See you all next week.